Hello and welcome to another IBM CPO Virtual Roundtable, presented in partnership with Ardent Partners. My name is Andrew Bartolini, Chief Research Officer at industry analyst firm Ardent Partners and publisher of the popular CPO Rising website, a site which focuses on topics that matter to CPOs and other procurement executives. Today, I will be the roundtable host and moderator. Now, working in concert with IBM, this roundtable is the third of a three-part series where we bring together several best-in-class chief procurement officers and tackle a specific theme, and then get these industry-renowned experts to share their best ideas, strategies, and practices in what we expect will be a lively and interactive roundtable discussion conducted over the phone. Today's theme is managing supply risk in the decade ahead. After listening to this roundtable, we invite all of you listening in to seek out the supporting materials that will be produced for this session. These materials can be found at IBM's website and will be highlighted on the website cporising.com. We will also have great discussions like the one today at our upcoming CPO Rising Summit this upcoming March in Boston. So my firm, Ardent Partners, is a research and advisory firm focused on defining and advancing the key strategies, processes, and technologies that drive operational excellence within global supply management operations. Our team has benchmarked thousands of distinct procurement operations across all aspects of their performance, and we produce research that organizations can use to improve their performance and make smart decisions. And finally, a quick word about our sponsor. With the MTORS acquisition, IBM is a world leader in providing strategic procurement solutions. IBM's offerings are solution-oriented with software, consulting services, process services, and operational best practices. And now to the stars of the show, our CPO panelists. First, we have Heidi Landry, a superstar CPO and longtime friend. Heidi joined Dow Corning in 2009 as the Chief Procurement Officer, which is her current role. She manages a global team across direct and indirect procurement with main office locations in the United States, Brazil, Europe, and Asia. Prior to Dow Corning, Heidi worked for 20 years in the procurement and supply chain area in a variety of roles for companies like Kmart, IKEA, and Novartis. During this time, she worked for 10 years in Asia. Of that, 7 years were in China and 3 in India, managing both procurement operations and joint venture manufacturing investments. Heidi relocated to Switzerland following her years in Asia and joined the pharmaceutical industry, where she worked in global procurement and supply chain roles based in Switzerland and in Greece prior to relocating to the United States and joining Dow Corning. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you.
Next, we have Bob Kane, another CPO who I've known actually now for more than a decade and have been tracking his fantastic career. Bob leads Ogin Incorporated's strategic sourcing, procurement, and contracting teams. Throughout his career, Bob has demonstrated a passion for the discipline and a track record of success in building corporate value for global operations of Fortune 100, mid-cap, and pre-revenue companies, all leaders in their respective industries. Regarded as a disciplined innovator, Bob's career has spanned a number of global and diverse markets, generating revenues up to and in excess of $10 billion annually. Aside from Ogin, his industry experiences include utility scale wind blade and composite structure manufacturing at TPI Composites, forest products for home building, containerboard packaging with Weyerhaeuser, and telecommunications C4I products and services with General Dynamics. He has had authority and oversight for global spend annually in excess of $3 billion, as well as success with large-scale implementations of enterprise spend management platforms and their integration to legacy systems. Bob's educational experience includes an MBA from Rivière University in New Hampshire, as well as a BS in business administration with a focus upon supply chain, operations, and procurement from Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He has been previously recognized as a top Protonou by the Supply and Demand Chain Executive publication. He's an accomplished speaker at industry conferences, and we plan to hear him speak in depth at the CPO Rising Conference this coming March in Boston. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks for the opportunity, Andrew.
Yeah, great. Lou Ferretti, our third, is the project executive for developing and leading these global and strategic programs across IBM's global supplier network. Lou's title, I should mention, is project executive, product environmental compliance, and supply chain social responsibility at IBM. You know, what he does there is leads these global and strategic programs across IBM's global supplier network. This includes environmental compliance, supply chain social responsibility, conflict minerals, risk management, business continuity planning, and sustainability. He is also global procurement's representative to IBM's corporate crisis management team. Now, the work that he's done has received many external and internal awards, including the ISM's Arjen Richter's Supply Chain Excellence Award for Sustainability. Now, prior to Lou's current work, he was on assignment in Singapore as Director of Production Procurement's Outsourced Supply Chain Operations, overseeing IBM's $6 billion buy-sell procurement spend. Among his many assignments within IBM, Lou has held senior management and executive positions in engineering, procurement, materials management, supply demand, operations, among others. Lou is a graduate of the City University of New York with a BS in engineering science. He's on the board of directors of the Triangle chapter in Raleigh, North Carolina, of the ISM. And prior to that, he was the vice president of ISM Seven Counties chapter in the New York, Connecticut areas. So I've given your backgrounds. What I'd like first to just start by asking each of you to take a few minutes to discuss your current role, your procurement organization and its mission, and how it operates within your company. And maybe Heidi, we'll start with you.
Sure, Andrew. Thanks for the very flattering introduction. I rarely get such star billing, but very welcome. So as you mentioned, I'm the CPO of Dow Corning. I started in 2009. It's been a very interesting 6 years. I manage both direct and indirect, and we have a spend of about $4.5 billion. When I started, about 50% of the direct spend was managed through the businesses instead of managed centrally in procurement. And as we reformulated the team and started to gain some momentum, we gradually shifted that in to the procurement function and added energy spend as well. So now my group manages essentially all procurement activity with the exception of insurance and some lease procurement activity or lease commercial management. We have a group that I directly manage of about 100 people, and then a group that is has a dotted line reported to me through the global shared services structure of about another 150. Out of that, 100 people are outsourced with a third-party service provider. So this was an output of a very significant project we went through in 2013 and implemented in 2014, where we outsourced and shifted to shared services a substantial amount of our transactional work. It resulted in a big change in the structure in that I managed the functional team of category managers, both global and local, as well as compliance, finance, market intelligence, reporting, et cetera. And the global shared services structure manages all of the buying transactions. I report organizationally into the chief financial officer of Dow Corning and have reported there for about 4 years. It's been beneficial for us because it enables, of course, a better linkage between procurement savings and budget impact when it comes to the planning process, and he's been a very strong advocate and supporter of our function. So I think I'll end there unless and hand it over to the next person for their introduction.
Yeah, no, that's great, Heidi. Bob, why don't we move to you next?
Certainly, Andrew, and once again, thank you for the opportunity here. My experience base is quite diversified, as Andrew pointed out, and I've further had the opportunity to work and structure teams and organizations in Fortune 100 industries, as well as my current position, which is running and constructing the supply chain team supporting a pre-revenue company by the name of Ogen. Ogen has been successful to date in producing a very innovative wind turbine based upon jet engine technology. We've raised over $265 million to date in VC funding, and we are rapidly moving from a low-rate initial production to a volume production phase for 2016 and 2017 globally. In my current role, we have a very scalable global supply network that we've structured to support this never-before-built turbine. I report directly into the COO as the final decision maker for all procurement, strategic sourcing activities, as well as the monitoring and source selection and alignment with our particular product needs themselves. We have a BOM that, rather, our product cost is about 60% BOM cost and 25% assembly and erection. And all of the teams that we have within that organization, that 85% of spend is managed through my team. Our short-term goals moving forward are we need to scale from a low-rate initial production to 500-plus turbines annually in a distributed generation market. We're targeting to have a design pipeline supporting a 10-week supply chain delivery to site. We have very aggressive targets to meet our levelized cost of energy and business case payback that relate to what's called a levelized cost of energy, which is the cost of power that the consumer pays. We have a strong reliance on our supply chain in China, and I have people that are working on the street in China, as well as people based in Denmark that manage our European supply base. So similar to Heidi, it's really the full scale of supply chain and procurement. The one difference, of course, especially with a smaller company as we are, is we have the transactional piece of it as well as supplier quality engineering, systems, and performance monitoring, as well as contract negotiations.
Wow, that's great. Bob, Lou, let's go over to you, all right? Another distinct organization, IBM.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So as you mentioned, I'm just going to clarify, I have product environmental compliance, so all the regulatory laws in all over the world that affect substances and chemicals and so forth that can't be in products. We ensure that all of IBM's products, as they're designed and put on the market, meet those laws. I also have another group that does supply chain social responsibility. We're founding members of the EICC, the Electronic Industry Citizenship Coalition, so we have our suppliers comply with that code of conduct, and we actually are very active in doing third-party audits, particularly in growth market countries, to ensure complete compliance to those that de facto code. I have several other groups. One is on risk, that we do supply chain risk across our supply base to understand the level of risk that these suppliers present, especially because so many of our suppliers and a great portion of our spend is in growth market countries these days. But a complement to that is business continuity management. So we need to understand the level of resiliency suppliers have in addition to the risk that they bring of physical and financial and otherwise. And then associated with that is supply chain sustainability. So that is something that, while it's not necessarily legal and mandatory, it certainly is something that's very important to clients and investors and shareholders and so forth. So we do have an award-winning program there that we require our suppliers to engage and participate in. So I, too, report to the CPO and Vice President of Procurement. I'll just quickly tell you, our spend is not the biggest, but it's about $30 billion, about $5 billion on production, and $25 billion actually on indirect. That's for us internal IBM as well as our clients. We do quite a bit of purchase for resale, and we're probably doing business with suppliers in 80 countries. We're selling in 173 countries, so our network is pretty expansive. Our procurement team is global. It reports into a CPO. We have 3,500 people in that organization. And the category managers cut across both production and the indirect side.
Oh, that's great. Now, that's great.
I was just going to share, procurement has come a long way in these years, so we believe that we've been a value-added partner both to development and engineering on technology roadmaps. On the indirect side, we do early involvement with both our client representatives and our clients as far as supplier's selection as far as giving them the best fit, the best value, the best price.
Yep. No, IBM's procurement practices and operations are certainly well-renowned, and in fact, they've been so successful it's actually turned into a revenue-generating opportunity for the company, obviously, as you know, Lou, but sharing that for those listening in. So I think this is fantastic, right? So we our main topic today is managing supply risk in the decade ahead. But before we do that, as we're sort of coming to, the cusp of 2016, I thought it would be interesting, particularly because we're dealing with, three procurement leaders coming from, different types of organizations, but was very interested to get your general perspectives on the way your teams, your procurement organizations are thinking about 2016. And what a few of the top priorities that you have are for the year ahead, and then we could start to drill into supplier risk. So Bob, why don't we start off with you here?
Sure, Andrew. Our top priorities really are focused pretty exclusively on a supply chain that is very much a positive fit with our team and our organization, and takes advantages of certainly many global markets out there that can give us what we term to be best cost country sourcing. We're also looking to take advantage of the renewed focus or the strong focus in renewables. Certainly the conferences that were recently going on, of which our president attended, certainly supported the need for alternative energy, such as wind, solar, hydro, et cetera, that could contribute to a less toxic environment, and in particular for global warming. So moving into that presents a great opportunity for us, and as such, we're diversifying into to new markets. Traditionally, we go in what's called the repower market, where we are replacing 20-year-old turbines on wind farms that we've purchased with our particular turbine. We can populate our turbine almost on a ratio of two-thirds of what the legacy turbine's on and produce the same amount of power. This distributed energy market that we're moving into is one that's more based on companies, large-scale companies, of which Heidi was employed by one of these at one time. I'll have to keep that somewhat confidential, but leave the guessing up to you folks, to where we position smaller numbers of wind turbines, 3 to 5 in particular, that provide power to warehousing, to manufacturing operations, and the like. Our key objective always for the year is continued cost out and cost down to our target and business case alignment. Otherwise, you have a very difficult time in raising more VC funding as we move forward. We're also participating in new markets. We have a heavy influence in California today. We're moving into the UK market. We're moving into the China markets over the course of the next year or so, which is opening up different challenges for us from a supply chain standpoint, and really forces us to look at other sources and countries of supply, simply because of the logistics associated with these large-scale parts. So, by and large, our chief goal within a company is to produce a levelized cost of energy that is best in class out there to all the alternative and traditional means of energy. And we'll do that in large part by that 85% of the turbine costs, which we control, ensuring that we have risk addressed in a way that maximizes our EBITDA.
Great. So let's turn that to you, and from the procurement perspective within this large global organization, what's the company, what's the procurement organization focused on for the upcoming year, and what are the priorities as you look at 2016? Lou, you may be on mute.
Okay, I was on mute. Okay, well, I would say that we've had a supplier and supply chain risk program in place for several years now, and it continues to mature, and we've complemented that, as I mentioned, with business continuity, which is the flip side of the risk versus the resiliency. What I'm doing here is looking at our entire end-to-end process, and I'm actually updating and revamping it with new programs and new tools to do more than we've been doing to fill gaps and to strengthen some existing programs. So I'm doing that internally, but I'm also looking at, you reference our services. We actually call it IBM Procurement Services, where we actually provide procurement services to many companies around the world. And one of the things we see that companies are asking for is a risk process or risk practice. So I'm looking at having the same thing we do internally, or a degree of similarity, to be able to be fashioned into offerings for our external clients. And beyond that, we have our consulting arm, our Global Business Services. I'm looking to do the same thing with them. So we'll have an opportunity to use our new set of tools across our internal, our services, as well as our consulting services organization. And this will just give us strength from the standpoint that as clients ask us about, you know, how good this is, we can certainly demonstrate that we're using it ourselves, and we've had a long history of using it, and we could demonstrate the benefits.
Great. Great, great. So, you know, I think I'm going to maybe circle right back here with you, Lou. Right. So, let's start to drill down into the topic of supply risk. And now, you know, just talking before we started the roundtable, that I believe that one of the challenges that the procurement industry has in really developing best practices is that around the management of supply risk, around the mitigation of supply risk, around the identification of supply risk, is that supply risk means so many different things, dependent upon the company or enterprise, depending upon where they're located, depending upon the industry. There's so many different variables that need to be brought into the discussion or need to be considered. And so maybe let's start with you, and then we'll go around to the others. And you know, how does IBM define supply risk in the context of its business and supply chains? And then, as a follow up to that question, you know, you're definitely, you know, highly involved in the management and approach. But talk a little bit about the organizational structure and general approach to supply risk. So first, define, you know, how do you define supply risk, and then, you know, what's the approach to managing it?
Okay, very good. So when we started this much more comprehensive program in 2009-2010, it was really focused on the physical aspect of risk, the immediate stoppage of some type of movement of goods through the supply chain. So that could be a political coup, as we've experienced in Thailand. It could be climatic factors of hurricanes and typhoons in Southeast Asia, or anything along that line. Those things will happen immediately and shut down the supply chain. A strike that's pending and then it gets executed in some port, all these things physically stop the movement of goods. So we had very heavy focus on that. In fact, our internal tool, we had nicknamed it Total Risk Assessment, TRA, because we wanted to look in totality of these types of risk. It could be impacts of financial risk, economic risk, social risk, civil risks, and so forth. All these things could come into play and stop the movement of goods or services immediately. We also recognize that there are things that are somewhat longer term. So, for instance, in our supply chain social responsibility program, when you have suppliers that might hit the media as far as some type of practice that they're doing that might be illegal or questionable, that's not going to shut you down today, but that's something that needs to be addressed, because if it's not addressed properly, it could cause an impact in the effect that we might not want to continue doing business with that supplier. So there's a two-tiered approach here. There's things that are of immediate nature, and there's things that are more of a medium nature that need to be addressed. So we need to keep our eye on the full range of risk activities. And one of the things I think you'll find very interesting, we've actually been using the power of Watson, our supercomputer. We did a proof of concept over the summer here for 4 months, and we're using Watson Content Analyzer and lots of information to look at storms and the effect of the storms and where they travel, how they travel, the intensity. All this we did by a core group of SMEs, subject matter experts, but now we've been able to use Watson to reveal much, much more information, to reveal it quickly and give us options as far as almost an event war room. If it goes this way, what can we do? How many suppliers? And we have a lot of past history as far as the storms, the different intensity. If it's Category 5 and it's 100 kilometers out, and it's going to hit at level 2 in a certain area, we know that that particular area can, no pun intended, weather the storm. And if it's going to hit a Category 4 or 5, we know that we need to take action. So we're actually using this tool now. We're going to build it out over the year, coming year, to look at both other climatic events as well as political and seismic events. So we hope to have it not only operationally internally within a year, but to have it commercialized.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, right? I remember reading, I think it was a short time ago, right? I think that IBM bought part of the Weather Channel, right?
And that is a made feed, right? We actually, before we bought it, we were using it. We were using it. Now that we have it, it's a much more integrated and integral part of this Watson effort.
Right, right, and so that makes more sense, right? I at the higher level, I was like, oh, maybe they're going to start going into broadcasting, considering how diverse the assets are. But no, I understand the practical application of the acquisition. Bob, maybe let's go to you now, right? So you know, different point in a company's maturity than IBM, certainly. Talk about you've got 60% of your cost tied up in BOM, but then there's also the installation and the integration of the different components. Talk and maybe explain to the listeners, how does Ogin and how do you define supplier risk in the context of the business and your global supply chain?
Certainly, Andrew. Given that we're a single-focused product now versus the broad authority that I've had in the past with much larger companies, it's supply chain risk is critical, and I view it really as a valuable component of any successful company's DNA. There's a right way and a wrong way to address supply chain risk, of which Lou touched on many of those points. Things that with prior organizations I've had great experience with implementing and being sensitive to as well. Bottom line is with so much of the spend that we own, we really categorize things on the basis of where it is on the critical path of the turbine construction. So typically no different than an ABC type of inventory classification. We focus pretty exclusively on A and B components because those are the ones that are customized for our particular applications. They're coming from China or Eastern Europe and have to have a significant amount of logistics time. And as a way to deal with those challenges, we have a number of processes that are built in to our particular success and performance management phases. And we've done that through the implementation of what we call must-win battle teams, which are comprised of every discipline but led by the supply organization so that we can have a single point but use the broad resources to manage and ensure that the performance as well as the cost associated with it meets our particular needs. And it's everything from quality, supply chain engineering, right on down the line. So it's worked very successfully. It keeps teams focused on their particular component or major assembly that is has to be fulfilled. It very easily deals with design changes. But it also enables through boots on the street that we have in those countries and physically at the plants of those suppliers that are manufacturing to ensure that the performance is what we need it to be and that we're responsive to any design changes that we have to implement since this is an evolving product.
Great. So Heidi, let's turn to you and look at Dow Corning and how you and your team and the company more broadly define supplier risk, looking at operations in the supply chain.
So at Dow Corning, we would start to look at the market segments that we're working in. So we range from commodity sales to very specialized sales. So we would look first at the market segment and how important, how many sources we have for each product or each service, if it's an essential service. We don't look at the spend that we have with the vendor because I think that's often a mistake
that organizations will make to look at who's big, who are we buying a lot from. We look more at the sales leverage that each purchase produces within the supply chain. So, for example, we could have a very small, unique catalyst that could leverage $1 billion of sales, but we may only spend $500,000 a year with that vendor. So we look at it more or less backwards from the sales impact, and we blow that back down to the material level. Then within those materials, we look at who we have that are single-sourced. Once we identify those vendors, we work in collaboration with our business units and the functions to develop a cross-functional team to manage that vendor. We've, like many organizations, have developed a fairly practical tool which picks from a menu of KPIs to assess the supplier's performance, develops a scorecard, and then develops an improvement plan. So that's the process we go through with our key vendors that we have identified and segmented as key due to these various risk factors. Then in addition to that, we monitor our priority vendors, which is a broader subsection of our vendor base, and every quarter generate a summary of their performance and look at the top 10% of bad actors within that vendor base and work to address the circumstances that have generated a supply performance deterioration. So it's a two-tiered approach, more or less. First,
mm-hmm.
and fundamentally, it's grounded on the market segment we're working in, whether it's commoditized or specialized. Then it looks at the nature of the sourcing that we do, single-sourced versus multi-sourced. And then it goes down to the resource levels that the business and the function are willing to put in to manage that supplier to gain a positive output. Because, like all organizations that are managing suppliers and managing supply risk, you have to manage it to improve it. There's no use to manage it just to manage it. If you can't document and demonstrate improvement, you'll have a hard time to convince other stakeholders to invest the time in it. So that's our basic process. And then we have to address ad hoc those issues that Lou has raised, for example, natural weather events. I think it's a very smart investment that IBM is doing to cope with those events and their increasing frequency. We have to manage strikes, industrial action, port slowdowns, et cetera. Those we do as more or less unique events versus because we don't have the predictability like IBM may have on when they'll occur and their impact. So we manage those on an ad hoc basis with a defined team.
Right. No, that's great. Right. So you know, next question really is the focus on international markets and having an international supply chain. And so, Bob, maybe I'll start with you. Right. So, you know, your business now and businesses you've managed in the past, right, they're dependent upon global suppliers to drive your product development and very specifically where you are today, you know, have a huge impact on your business. So I'm wondering if you could describe some of the strategies and approaches that you've employed at Dogen, or at some of your other companies where you've worked to, you know, the strategies that you've employed to face the challenges of managing an international supply base and the differences in your approach to supply risk based upon where the suppliers are located.
Certainly, Andrew. I mean, there are a number. Certainly, many of us have dealt with international supply chains, and each one has kind of a identity of its own. China is different from Turkey, is different from Brazil. And it's important to understand the political as well as the economic makeup of those countries, as well as the dynamics of their personalities and decision-making processes to move forward. Having spent a lot of time in China, and more recently, too much time, I might add, we've tried to mitigate our supply risk through a very formal practice, which is akin to the must-win battle team that I highlighted earlier. We have contract review boards that are in place that go through a detailed step-by-step analysis. We have a five-step gated sourcing process that we use that covers everything from market assessment, outsourcing to insourcing decisions. We typically like to have production of sample parts, even large-scale sample parts, as well as evaluating the traditional things like financial, country, currency risk, and others that may come up at one point or another from a challenge standpoint. One of our big successes has been based upon dual sourcing. And dual sourcing is really something that if you don't want your supply line to break down, in my view, and you're trying to deal with challenges of parts on the water or an extraordinary situation that may crop up, it's important to have somebody that is or a partner that is also located more locally to us that you can juggle that supply chain impact that you may be experiencing overseas. We traditionally have 75% of our spend that's based with the primary overseas best cost country sourcing partner, as well as 25%, which is more logistically friendly with some upside potential. We also carry, we tend to partner with global leaders that are and try to elevate our assembly to the highest possible point so that we have ease in shipping as opposed to doing nothing but chasing parts and then trying to assemble them over here in country. So that's been very successful so that we can just ship major assemblies directly to site for installation. We carry additional inventory for time on the water concerns. There's variability in that. We've talked about embargoes and strikes at the ports. Those are always things that are surprises, even as much as you try to plan for those things. But most of all, our success has been based upon having boots on the street. You need people. We have people physically located at those factories. We have a team that goes in and audits from a compliance, from a quality standpoint right on down the line. We do a number of checks on the financial stability of those partners we deal with. We check for things such as compliance to areas such as ITAR and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And we're very sensitive with our representation in country to any of the risks that may pop up from the standpoint of political, economic, or otherwise. And there are a lot of things that we have to be sensitive to these days. There's whether it's a change in the country's focus, such as China now addressing its pollution and environmental impact that it's having to more of a clean tech type of approach, one which will actually will scale back on the number of suppliers and complete some unemployment in that country. But those are the types of things that you really need to be sensitive to. Finally, contractually, the things that are important to us are IP protection, obviously, because of the nature of our particular technology. We escrow the technology so that we have insurance that we can get our technology back or get what is developed for us easily in the case of a unfortunate business development. We have cash performance incentives such as letters and credits and milestones, things that are typical but sometimes not taking into the level of consideration that they should. And we try to partner with the parent operation to avoid any walled-off entities that could create a worst-case scenario. So finally, Andrew, the question is really the team's agility and realism associated with an alternative plan. If you don't have one, you're not going to be able it's all about how quickly you can react to a challenge as opposed to having to and having the infrastructure and process as opposed to trying to react to it and create the process on the fly.
No, that's great, Bob. You know, now I think I'd like to look at supplier qualification and ongoing management, and let's turn to Heidi. I do know very directly that Dow Corning has really become one of the industry's leading procurement organizations, particularly when it comes to direct materials. And so I'd like you to share with the audience, can you explain, your company's approach to qualifying suppliers from a supplier risk context and what you do, from an ongoing standpoint to maintain and monitor their performance, track and mitigate any changes in supply risk?
Sure, Andrew. I hope this is not too duplicative with my earlier comments, but please cut me off if so. Dow Corning has had to become good in supplier qualification and management because we are in a specialty market. We have relatively low COGS and a high profitability, especially in our specialty segment. So whatever we do, we in procurement, we can't afford to shut down the supply chain. So we've done a couple of things that I think have improved our risk posture in this area. First is we have a defined pre-qualification process. With vendors that come on site, specifically, for example, construction services or other vendors that have to be frequently on-premise, we have outsourced that as a service to a third party. We do internally the standard checks, for example, a D&B creditworthiness and et cetera, but we've outsourced the main work of getting the pre-qualification set up, a pre-audit, agreement on the standard terms, NDAs, et cetera. So once a vendor has been qualified to supply, audited as appropriate by our site teams, then they would come into the system and we would segment them to three different levels, so key, priority, and foundational. This would be based on a number of factors. So part of it is their sales leverage, if we can track that, if it's a direct material. If it's a service or some other type of product, not a direct material, it would be based on what type of product or service they're supplying and is it a key priority for the company. Other criteria would be, you know, are they single source? What are market conditions, labor or environmental conditions? Is it a fence line facility? Is it an ownership or a subsidiary relationship? So, for example, we have two owners. Are they connected with our owners or a subsidiary of them? Is it a JV, of course? And what advantage would we have from a proactive management of this vendor? So, we segment them into three criteria, key, priority, and foundational. And then, according to those three criteria, we would have three different management methods. Now, I'll frankly admit, given our supplier volume and the workload we have with the staffing we have, we do not proactively manage foundational suppliers, which are the vast majority. We would only manage on an issue resolution basis. So when something goes wrong, we'll address them. But we put quite a bit of time into managing our key suppliers. Again, that's in conjunction with our business or functional stakeholders. So what we have found important in this is that the stakeholders that are using those suppliers as a key raw material import or key service, they have to be committed to dedicating some time to manage them because otherwise we won't gain any traction within procurement managing them without stakeholder input. And we have to have a defined business goal that we want to reach through managing them. Again, it's as if you give your money to a stockbroker. You're not satisfied if they just keep status quo. You have to drive some improvement that is defined. It's likely not going to be cost-saving related, but it could be a leaner supply chain, improved delivery service, for example, a reduced inbound inventory, faster response time, a dedicated key account manager. It depends on the requirement of the business. So those key suppliers, we've currently identified 50, and are proactively managing a portion of them. So far, it's been, I think, very successful, has received very good input from the businesses, as, of course, they see on the commercial side that our customers require us to innovate. They require us to add value consistently. Why aren't we doing that with our supplier base? Middle tier of suppliers, the priority suppliers, are monitored quarterly, as I mentioned, so I won't go through that in greater detail. We act on 10% of the bad actors. So we take the top 10% that have deviated from their shipment performance or delivery or quality performance, and we address those up through the category management team, and then we review all those actions and intervene as necessary at the management level. Foundational suppliers are simply managed on an as-needed basis due to workload considerations. So in 2016, supplier management is actually our top priority, and we're focusing on that and have enlisted our CFO and CEO to help us launch our first annual Supplier Day. So it's an area of a lot of focus for us.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And so let's now turn to Lou and talk a little bit about contingency planning, right? So Lou, besides your current work focused on IBM's global supplier network, you've also been, on the operational side, right? You've managed large multi-billion-dollar supply chains, You've served on IBM's Executive Pandemic Steering Committee, where you developed policies and implementation plans. Right? You referenced Watson earlier, looking to better predict potential disruptions and how you're leveraging that technology. But maybe speak more broadly. What are some of IBM's best practices when it comes to contingency planning?
Okay, good. Thank you. So, of course, on the production side, there are just basic things that we've heard before about second sourcing, protective stock, maybe digital qualification, even vendor-managed inventory, hubs, and so forth, and pulling product in. So and there's several other things that we do that are standard part of our practice. But on the contingency side there, by doing an assessment on the risk and also the level of resiliency a supplier has, we know how either strong or soft that situation is. In fact, we have a situation where all suppliers need to get up to a minimum level of, I'm going to say, contingency planning, at least defined by us. They can certainly exceed that, but we give them some fundamentals that they need to consider. And you harken back to part of my history here. I'll give you an example. In Singapore, when SARS hit, as opposed to maybe other countries, when Singapore government says you're quarantined, everybody stays home. Nobody ventures out. And it was a problem because people had their laptops or their information at work or their printers or whatever things, or they had access to information that was behind a firewall. So it really made us think, in addition to when pandemic occurred, what are the things that, how do you keep your business running? So we did an exhaustive study ourselves, looking across all our business units and our vital processes, of what are the things that could disrupt us in an event where, say, workers could not go to the office. How would we continue to run business? So we have learned a great deal ourselves as far as examining our own internal processes of how to keep our business running in a degraded mode when these things happen. And by a similar situation, we've actually applied this to our suppliers. So in a part of our business continuity management program, we ask our suppliers to look at if they had excessive absenteeism, if they've lost power, if they lost IT, can they have their employees work at home? We have found in our own case that many times people either weren't taking their laptops home or they had a desktop and they couldn't work from home. So as fundamental as that is, we have enabled our entire workforce that we deem critical to be able to access the tools, programs that they need from remote locations. So we really try to think this through so that most disasters or interruptions would be transparent to us if that could be possible. Even switching locations on call centers and other things that we do internally, we'd like our suppliers to be thinking about those things also. I'll just share a thought here. While we extend quite a bit of help to our suppliers as far as the education there, we certainly don't want to be prescriptive and say, here's the 10 things that you need to plan for, because we might not have thought about all the things that they need to plan for. It's really incumbent upon the suppliers to recognize that they need to have a resiliency plan that addresses their business so that they can continue to provide goods and services uninterrupted, not only to IBM, but the rest of their clients, and they need to protect their business, their revenue, their employees, and so forth. So it's in everyone's best interest to be thinking about the full range of contingency planning and doing lessons learned and testing. So we have found that to be very valuable, too. We do that internally, and we also do that with our suppliers. I'll just add one quick thing here. We now have a corporate risk management office and also a corporate business continuity. So we are looking across the entire 430,000 of us, our 13 business units, and we're applying those same approaches internally that I apply to the suppliers. So we have a very strong interconnect between our external business with our suppliers and our internal operations.
Great. Lou,
comment on one thing. Lou brought up something that's very important, too. It's risk management and your plans for such are not just at the direct supplier base that you're dealing with or your partners. It's also at your suppliers. So I know one thing we demand, and I'm sure Lou and Heidi confirmed the same type of philosophy, is we look for those same risk mitigation plans to be briefed as part of the source selection process, whether it's quality, performance, country, manufacturer, et cetera. those have to be flowed down so that you can avoid any uncertainty in their supply chains as well as your own.
No, that's great. Lou, Bob, Heidi, you know, I think this has been a fantastic discussion, right? Another, I think, highly successful CPO virtual roundtable. You know, we picked the topic of supply risk because Arden Partners research has shown that, you know, the average procurement organization is relatively unsophisticated when it comes to managing supply risk, right? That, you know, sort of the top strategy in the market today is that organizations are really just trying to get their hands around identifying and defining supply risk for their organization. So I think it's been a very valuable conversation that we've had here today for organizations to hear from three industry leaders and their approaches to supply risk. So I'd like to thank Heidi Landry from Dow Corning. I'd like to thank Bob Cain from Ogen, and I'd like to thank Lou Ferretti from IBM for a fantastic conversation. And as I noted at the top of the call, there will be some supporting materials and information and analysis and discussion that will be available online at both the IBM and CPO Rising websites. So again, thank you to the three of you, and thank you, listeners, as well.